From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Friday, August 5th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. Today, the economy is weak, the markets are all over the place, but President Obama keeps the faith.
What I want the American people and our partners around the world to know is this. We are going to get through this. Things will get better.
But many global investors are looking for something other than nice words.
More leadership from politicians in dealing with the really difficult questions, which they're just not doing.
We'll have that story and much more coming up.
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com and by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at IBM.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Overseas stocks fell for an eighth straight day today. It's been a dizzying descent. If you want to tally up the damage, and maybe you don't, global equities have lost $2.5 trillion in value this week. There was a bit of sunshine in the markets today. Lo and behold, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 61 points. It closed the day at 11,445. That finish could have something to do with the fact that the Labor Department reported today that America's unemployment rate dipped 0.1 percentage point to 9.1%. Louise Cooper is with London-based brokers BGC Partners. She says the markets may go up and down, but the global economic problems are persistent.
The underlying fundamentals have not changed, and they are still dire. So the debt deal didn't solve the problem. Slightly stronger unemployment report, still concerned about a recession. And the bigger picture, politicians and policymakers not grabbing hold of these problems and sorting them out.
So what's changed, say, in the past week?
I think it's a slow realization by many investors that crawling out of this big, deep hole of debt that we have got ourselves into will take a long time. And I think the problem here is we've got a catch-22 situation. We need lots of growth to pay back our debt, and yet the massive amounts of debt means that growth is difficult. And what policy levers are there left?
And when you mention political uncertainty and whether or not politicians have what it takes to deal with this, it sounds like the markets are saying right now, we're not so sure.
It's truly extraordinary. I look at the States and think, this is the world's largest economy, and it almost went to default. I mean, that is a failure of the political class. Then you look at Europe, and it seems to be the same in the Eurozone. They are making the situation worse, not better, with their comments. Yesterday, we had José Manuel Barroso, who is the European Commission president. He said, we need to help out more. We need to help these peripheral countries more, these highly indebted countries. Today, we have a German politician saying, no, it's verboten. We're not writing bank checks. Well, if they're going to have a row, please do it behind closed doors. Don't have it publicly, because all that does is makes international investors terribly nervous that there are disagreements at the highest level in terms of sorting this mess out.
Louise, when we see the fluctuations in the market, are those fluctuations a symptom or are they the problem?
A volatility is the price of fear. That's the way you look at it. It's very nervous investors, very nervous traders, very nervous salespeople. High volatility is never a good thing, and it indicates how terribly fearful most people are, because you don't know what a price should be. If you're confident in your economic growth figures, if you're confident in your forecasts for company, if you're confident your banking industry will be strong in a month's time, then you can price that. But if you are highly uncertain about many, many, many things, then you can't accurately price anything, which is why you get extreme volatility. And markets hate uncertainty.
How come we're seeing jitters in even emerging markets, which have been doing well?
Emerging markets are highly dependent on the U.S. economy. If we think the U.S. economy is going to go back into recession, emerging markets will find it difficult to perform. They still may well perform a little, but it's tough when the world's superpower is not performing. And if Europe goes into recession, it's tough when Europe and America go into recession for other countries to do well.
So what could be said at this point or done at this point to settle the markets? I mean, the markets ebb and flow. They seem to do it all at once, all together right now, because they are so linked. What could create stability?
We could really do with some better news on economic growth. I think that's unlikely. And I think more leadership from politicians in dealing with the really difficult questions, which they're just not doing. You know, the tough decisions, either we bail out Greece and we transfer massive amounts of wealth to Greece or Spain or Ireland or Portugal or Italy, and we just accept that is the price for the Eurozone, or we allow them to exit the Eurozone, they devalue and they go it alone. Everyone thinks we can just fudge through this middle way. And I think what a lot of investors are saying are, we can't. You need to make the tough decisions. Germany, bail out the rest of the Eurozone, or allow these countries to exit.
Okay, just one final question. I wonder, for you, someone outside the United States, and this involves more certainly than Washington, but what do you see as the major problem in terms of direction here in the US?
I think from a European perspective, the politics doesn't seem to be quite so visceral as it is in the States. And I think a lot of us here in Europe look at the intransigence, particularly of the Tea Party Republicans, and find it utterly bewildering that they would be willing to risk their sovereign nation for a political point scoring exercise. You know, politics is all about compromise and taking your country to the edge of a potential default seems an extraordinary thing to risk. And they should be so glad that they're in the United States of America, because if they were any other country in this world, they would not get away with it.
Louise Cooper of Brokers BGC Partners in London, who's clearly no admirer of the Tea Party, but more than a third of Americans are, according to recent polls. The Tea Party has risen to the fore by taking aim at spending across the board. That includes the military and foreign assistance of all kinds. The World's Jason Margolis checked in with some supporters of the Tea Party movement to find out just what they have in mind.
The Tea Party doesn't have a central spokesman or organizing body. It's a loose coalition of people united by beliefs in spending cuts, lower taxes, and smaller government. Chris Littleton of Cincinnati is one who subscribes to those principles.
We really need across-the-board cuts, and nothing can be a sacred cow, nothing can be off-limits, and that's going to include defense.
Littleton co-founded the Ohio Liberty Council. He says the defense budget has become bloated. He argues that's because the military has lost sight of its constitutional mission.
It does not include being the world's police, being the world's peacemaker, or trying to advance our culture or causes around the world as a singular purpose. It's for common defense. And so if we are not directly threatened and we are not involved in an altercation that we need to defend ourselves, then we can absolutely scale back our operations from throughout the world. So I'd be for both domestic and foreign military installations being brought back, trimmed down, and hopefully many of them even eliminated.
Support for a smaller military runs counter to what many conservative Republicans espouse. But Tea Party supporter Jason Rink argues that's because Republicans haven't been acting like real conservatives. He's executive director of the Foundation for a Free Society in Austin, Texas.
Traditional conservatives, they believe we should have a humble foreign policy. They believe that we shouldn't police the world. They believe that we shouldn't get into foreign wars, and that our defense spending needed to be something that we addressed and we were modest about.
The new push to reduce the debt could result in cuts to the Pentagon's budget of up to $1 trillion over a decade. That would be about 14% of its operating budget. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says cuts that large would imperil the nation's security. And such cuts would impact tens of thousands of people who work in the defense industry. But many Tea Party sympathizers say that to call a $1 trillion cut steep is an exaggeration.
I mean, I guess steep is really all just perspective. I don't think anyone's really proposing steep cuts, and there should be.
That's Michael Bolden. He's executive director of a group called the 10th Amendment Center in Los Angeles.
An activist organization that believes in following the Constitution every issue, every time, no exceptions, no excuses.
Bolden opposed the war in Iraq and the military campaign in Libya. He calls them unconstitutional acts. Bolton not only wants to cut the U.S. military budget, he also wants to cut funds for foreign military assistance dramatically.
I think they should be eliminated completely, 100%.
The U.S. distributes $14 billion annually in military assistance. Most of it goes to Afghanistan, Iraq, Israel, Egypt, and Pakistan. Bolton argues that those payments don't advance our interests.
Funding one side or another overseas has led to far more problems than it has benefits, and it's time for it to end, morally, economically, and then also constitutionally.
But to cut foreign military assistance entirely, we don't live in a vacuum. Isn't that a little, please don't take offense, but isn't that a little politically naive? What happens?
I don't take offense. I actually would say the other way around. I think it's naive to think that that we should be so arrogant as to think that we can determine what side's the good side in very complex overseas issues. And I think the historical record, if it hasn't already shown, is that the U.S. has many times taken the wrong side.
But military experts point out that the U.S. government isn't really in the business of picking the good side. Washington provides military assistance to foreign governments because it perceives such aid to be in the national interest. For example, the U.S. gives aid to Pakistan not necessarily because the leaders are the good guys, but because it's not in America's interest for Pakistan's nuclear-armed government to collapse. There's another element of foreign assistance, non-military economic aid. That comes out to $34 billion annually for things like food, agricultural development, and AIDS prevention in Africa. Overall, it's about 1% of the U.S. budget. No big surprise, foreign aid is not very popular among Tea Party supporters. Again, Chris Littleton.
We cannot possibly think about trying to help out other countries before we have our own backyards in order. It's not about politics or picking one cause or one country. It needs to be cut across the board. This isn't a personal decision. It's just, it's a mathematical one. This is a financial decision that has to be made.
I asked Littleton if denying food to starving people or medicine to the sick might be considered heartless.
Is it more heartless to keep them dependent on another nation for something? Doesn't that perpetuate the suffering? Doesn't that perpetuate the problems?
I support helping people. Absolutely support helping people.
Again, Tea Party supporter Michael Bolton.
But I am not under the belief that the U.S. government is a responsible organization to help people. I think that should be left to private individuals, to private organizations.
Foreign aid has generally had the support of Democrats and Republicans. Microsoft founder Bill Gates puts it this way. The small amount we spend helping the world's poorest not only saves millions of lives, it also has an enormous impact on developing economies, which in turn impacts our economy. And the international relief organization Oxfam points out that the main reasons that the U.S. assists poor countries are to enhance national security, promote our economic interests, and provide moral leadership. But Tea Party members and followers say the best way to enhance national security, promote our economic interests, and provide moral leadership is to get our own economic house in order. And that means cut spending by however much you can, wherever you can. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Got a question for you now. Do you think the U.S. should cut spending by however much it can, wherever it can? Post your comments online at theworld.org. Coming up later in today's program, actor and director John Turturro and his musical tribute to the city of Naples with its brutality and beauty.
It really reminded me very much of New York in the 70s because your senses are on high alert.
John Turturro's passion for Naples coming up later on PRI. That's Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. It happened 1 year ago today at a copper mine in Chile. 33 miners were trapped when the mine collapsed. They stretched a meager store of emergency food for 17 days until rescuers arrived at the scene and began the hard work of getting the miners out. More than 2 months later, Luis Ursúa became the last miner to be rescued.
Everyone watching these last few moments as Luis Ursúa arrives at the service. This is it, the moment that 33 miners were saved in 22 hours. Can you believe it?
That was then. Now, though, the glory has faded. Jonathan Franklin is the author of the book 33 Men. He's in Santiago, Chile. Thank you for speaking with us, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
I've got another little bit of tape I'd like to play. This one is from an interview with one of the rescued miners named Dario Segovia.
Yo soy Dario Segovia, no un minero que tuvo una desgracia.
What he's saying there is he's had a very bad time of things. He says there's no money, or at least he has no money anyway. What he does have, he says, is the will to work. Jonathan, how typical is the situation for the other 32 men who are also trapped in the mine?
I think if you had to sum up their current state of affairs, you'd say plenty of fame, but no fortune. They're really hurting. They feel abandoned, and they're feted by the world as heroes, but they still go back home to houses that sometimes don't even have running water.
And how could that be the case? Didn't they receive some money from the government and some gifts as well right after they were rescued?
Each man was given about $15,000 by a Chilean charity, but that money is long gone, and the men are living off a pension that is maybe one-third to one-half of their regular salary. And they're kind of seen as damaged goods. Nobody wants to hire them in the sense that, you know, they're afraid of the dark. They get nightmares. You know, one guy who's a mechanic, one of the miners, he said to me, "Jonathan, I'd be afraid to fix your car. I might screw it up." So really, they have this tremendous need for psychological treatment and really no understanding of where they've been dropped.
Are they getting any kind of psychological treatment, those who need it?
They are getting treatment. Sometimes they go, sometimes they don't go. But when you talk to the men, you really get a sense that nobody sat them down and explained, you know, the stages of grief, the stages of recovery. They really seem to be floundering.
Some of these men, though, we know, have traveled around the globe telling their story. Do they not get anything for that kind of work?
Probably five or six of them are making a very healthy income, giving speeches, talking about their experiences. But the rest of them are reduced to selling fruits and vegetables on the streets. And, you know, they call me up and say, you know, "Jonathan, would you like to buy some rocks I have from the bottom of the mine? Or how much do you think a signed flag goes for?" They're really scratching the bottom of the barrel.
That's terribly sad. There is one particular man, and I think anybody who watched the rescues won't be surprised by who it is, who seems to be doing very well.
The second miner up was a guy named Mario Sepulveda, who you probably remember because he danced and ran around and pumped his fist and hugged the president. He says, you know, this collapse was the best thing that ever happened to him. He was a natural leader waiting for the situation. But Mario is exceptional in many ways. And so it's kind of this illusion that you see him giving a speech and him smiling. You think maybe they're all doing okay, but he's quite a group apart.
Jonathan, Chile's mining minister has said that mining is much safer now in Chile, is it?
He's probably right, but it has less to do with the effects of the government and more to do with the knowledge that any mining accident in Chile now will be headlined. So if you're a mine owner, you now realize that even a single miner killed means headlines splashed across Chile, maybe the world. So I think that, more than government inspection, is the real factor here.
All right. Jonathan Franklin's book is called 33 Men. It chronicles the rescue of the 33 Chilean miners who were trapped in a cave-in 1 year ago today. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
From underground in Chile now, we move to underwater in the Caribbean. And we're looking for the largest of the Bay Islands, or Islas de la Bahía. This island is 30 miles off the coast of Honduras. It's a good place to go if you want to retire on a budget. You can live very nicely there for a little over $2,000 a month. And it was a good place to go if you were a lionfish. A lot of lionfish went down to the area about 3 or 4 years ago, but they've been gobbling up local fish stocks. So Honduran fishermen are training sharks to hunt the unwelcome guests. Suffice to say, the island may no longer be a good place to retire if you're a lionfish. The answer to our geo quiz and the place where sharks are acquiring a taste for lionfish is the island of Roatan. Photographer Antonio Busiello took a series of stunning pictures of the shark training program near Roatan. The pics are at theworld.org. Take a look. Mr. Busiello is now in Tuscany. And how did you end up swimming with the fishes?
Well, I know the islands. I know Roatan very well. I've been working there for different years. But I found out about the lionfishes. I mean, I didn't know that there was this problem in the Caribbeans. And you dive and you can see lionfish pretty much everywhere. This is unusual. In some part of the reef, in some spot, you can see like 40, 50 lionfish in one dive.
What do they look like?
They are beautiful. The pectoral fins are very big. And the colors are, you know, red, white. They are very bright. And the spines are big too. So, I mean, they are a very beautiful fish to see. And it's actually one of the reasons why people go to diving. So it's a kind of like, it's pretty sad, you know, to kill them. But actually in the Caribbean, they can really represent a huge problem.
So the huge problem is that they devour the local fish.
Yes, they can actually stop the food chain, you know, at the first step. They're going to eat all the little fishes.
So basically they devour the local fish and they interrupt the food chain. But then you have the massive gray reef sharks there as well with these kind of flat iron noses. Now, the thing is, they're trying to get the sharks to eat the lionfish, but it is an acquired taste. So how do you train a shark to develop a taste for some new prey?
Yeah. I don't know if you can use the word train. They can be trained, but you can make them understand that it's something that they can start to feed off. So some marine biologists suggest at the beginning, kill the lionfish and feed the shark with a dead lionfish so the shark can taste it. Then they start to hunt the fish by himself.
So first they skewer it and then feed it to the shark, so the shark kind of says, this isn't bad. And then they actually wound the fish, and then the shark can eat it itself.
Yeah. And another problem is the locals, fishermen and local people, they don't fish them, they don't eat them, because they don't know them, and also because they have the spines that has poison, so people are afraid. So one of the strategies was to teach people that they are pretty tasty, that they can be eaten. Once you remove the spines, they are not dangerous at all.
You have an amazing picture of two sharks eyeing this badly wounded lionfish. All the pictures are going to be on our website, theworld.org. Like I said, it must be hard. You know, the lionfish are really beautiful, but what was it like to be down there and so close to what was going on?
Well, yeah, it's not easy. I don't spare fish. I'm a photographer. Anytime I go in the water, I take my camera with me. But I did it with the lionfishes because sometimes we went out just to fish them. And it's not easy. But if you understand the kind of danger that they can represent for the Caribbean reef, it's the only way to do.
Well, Antonio Busiello, really nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much, Lisa.
Antonio Busiello's photos, once again, can be found at theworld.org. Congratulations today to Ben from Lakewood, New Jersey, Anna from Sacramento, California, and also Susan from Birch Island, Maine. They are today's selected winners who answered our GeoQuiz correctly from their telephones. You can play along, too. Just text GeoQuiz to 69866, 69866. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullins. Coming up, it's another deadly day in Syria. Activists use videos to get the message out about violence perpetrated by Syrian forces.
You see, they shot just on innocent people. You see how they run. They will die for freedom.
PRI's The World is brought to you with support from Medtronic, leveraging products, people, and philanthropy to help lessen the global impact of chronic non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and heart disease, and announcing that this September, world leaders will come together at the United Nations to chart a global response to this health issue. Learn more at Medtronic.com. and by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The revolutions that started to sweep the Arab world early this year caught up to Syria in March. Protesters poured onto the streets to demand the resignation of the president, Bashar al-Assad. But the uprising in Syria became more dangerous than its predecessors in Tunisia and Egypt. Syrian security forces have assaulted demonstrators and laid siege to entire cities. This is purportedly gunfire from the besieged city of Hama. It's from an amateur video that was posted today on the internet. The video could not be independently verified. Friday has become the main day for protests in Syria, despite the near certainty that troops will respond with deadly force. The BBC's Lina Sinjab is in Damascus. Lina, there are reports that tens of thousands of Syrians have been out on the streets protesting today. What can you tell us about what's happening?
Well, this is what's happening, but these days the protesters are taking to the streets not only calling for their own freedom, but they are going out in solidarity with besieged cities like Deir ez-Zor and Homs, and mainly the city of Hama that has been besieged and under shelling by the army for 5 days in a row since Sunday, where many people, tens of people, are believed to have been killed.
The city of Hama itself, as you mentioned, a place where government tanks had rolled into the streets earlier in the week. How are you getting information from Hama? Because reportedly the internet and electricity and phone services have all been cut off.
Well, the first couple of days, some of the activists had satellite phones on them that we would be able to call them and contact them and get the news from them to describe to us what's happening on the ground. But since 2 days ago, even the satellite phones have been completely cut off. And the only news we're getting is the news we're getting from people who are managing to flee the city and come to Damascus or other cities where we can establish contacts with them. Having said that, many families who tried to flee the city were also shot at, and at least we know that one family has been completely killed by the army while they were trying to flee the city of Hama.
What other information are you getting from those who do flee successfully?
Well, the stories they're telling are really a horrible story. The military is shelling indiscriminately, and lots of people have been killed. And the worst thing is that they're targeting hospitals because they don't want anyone to get any treatment. And protesters believe that they're trying to attack hospitals because they don't want any calculations of the casualties. So after Sunday, where activists told us that at least 140 were killed in one single day, it's been hard for activists to calculate the numbers of the casualties.
Lina, the government itself, when it moves troops and tanks into certain areas, how is it deciding what areas it wants to overtake?
Well, the government has always been claiming that they're only interfering because there are armed gangs, which the families and the residents and the human rights activists are completely denying these allegations. And Hama was one of the cities that witnessed the largest protests across the country, where 500,000 are believed to have taken to the streets on a Friday. The city of Hama seemed for the authorities as gaining power, and this is something that the government would not allow. They would want to keep control of the city.
Is there any way to verify that those who are fighting against the government are otherwise peaceful citizens versus militants who are fighting not on behalf of the people?
We have followed the situation since day one of the protest, and it all showed that these protesters have been going out completely peacefully. But in later situation, we've heard that people managed to use their own light weapons or create their own weapons like handmade Molotovs just to defend themselves against this heavy artillery that the Syrian security and the army is using against these residents and protesters who are actually unarmed, but they're just using, in very limited cases, light weapons to defend themselves.
All right. Speaking to us from Damascus, Syria, the BBC's Lina Sinjab. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Syrian opposition is diverse. Activists come from different economic, social, and religious groups. There are protesters inside Syria, refugees who fled the crackdown, and longtime dissidents in exile. One opposition group, made up of refugees who fled northern Syria, are working from a house in Antakya in southern Turkey. Matthew Brunwasser went to visit.
The Syrian opposition is trying hard to get its do-it-yourself revolution cooking. It's breakfast for eight young revolutionaries. Most have never lived away from their mothers before. The setup in this house is pretty basic. Most of the guys sleep on the floor, and they are doing the cooking and cleaning for the first time in their lives. And they've certainly never worked in politics before. Political activity in Syria for the last 40 years has meant supporting the ruling Ba'ath Party or jail. These men came here just a few weeks ago from the refugee camps inside Turkey after an opposition supporter agreed to pay the rent. Nazir al-Abdo is one of the leaders. He was studying sports at the university in Latakia before he fled. Al-Abdo and the others don't have documents, so their movements are limited.
We don't go outside at all. Not anybody see us, so we always hiding. We don't have the right to be here. We don't have passport.
Al-Abdo didn't have much time to think before he fled. He was involved in protests and still went to classes like a normal student. But then 10 minutes before his exam, his phone rang.
My brother called me and said, "Don't enter. The secret forces will come to your university and take you." I said, "It's not possible. I will go to the exam just..." He said, "They will come and take you." I didn't go to the exam.
The television in the living room shows grainy cell phone images of corpses and chaos in Syria. It's the opposition Syrian Al-Shab satellite channel. The activists here prepare videos like these to get the message out about what they call crimes against civilians by Syrian security forces. Digital imagery is perhaps the most powerful tool available to the inexperienced, unorganized, and underfunded opposition. Al-Abdo shows me a video he says is from the town of Idlib.
You see a lot of people running from the shooting. You see another guy get shot in his leg. You see the blood? It's a lot of blood. And they didn't have ambulance. You hear the shooting. Tick, tick. This guy is dying now because nobody takes them to hospital. You see the blood.
The men in this house may not go out, but they do get visitors. Young men show up with more videos smuggled out on flash drives. One of them is a 20-year-old who wants to be called Ahmed. He snuck out of his refugee camp. Ahmed says that if he's caught outside the camp, Turkish authorities could send him back to Syria. Of course it's dangerous, Ahmed says, but I will do it for Syria because I have to help. The world needs to hear our stories. The oldest revolutionary here, at 35, is Jamil Saeb.
When the protests started in Syria, we had to create a new strategy. We had no organization. People just came out and said whatever they felt like saying. Now we are on to the next level.
Saeb says the opposition wants Syria to be like Egypt, not Libya. In other words, to topple the regime through peaceful people power and international pressure. He says violence simply won't work in Syria. His priority, he says, is to create a small unified organization and present clear ideas to the world by doing things such as translating its Arabic web pages into English.
It's a serious problem because we don't have money. These opposition groups we just met in Turkey, they spent a lot of money for a five-star hotel, for talking and meetings and accomplishing nothing. We should be using this money for technology, logistics, translations, and communications.
You see, they shot just on innocent people. You see how they run. They will die for freedom.
Nazir al-Abdo is frustrated. No foreign reporters are allowed in Syria, so independent verifications of activists' accounts are not possible. And he's tired of having to prove that the Syrian government is brutalizing its people. But clearly the message is getting out. The United Nations has condemned the Assad regime in Syria. But al-Abdo and others wonder why America and Europe aren't doing more. For The World, I'm Matthew Brunwasser, Antakya, Turkey.
You can explore the rest of Matthew's reports all this week along the Turkish-Syrian border. We've got photos of activists and the journey many refugees are taking from Syria into Turkey. That's all at theworld.org. Last month marked the 17th anniversary of the death of a very influential rabbi called simply the Rebbe. Menachem Mendel Schneerson was the last leader of the Orthodox Jewish movement known as Chabad. From his headquarters in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, he expanded the movement into what it is today, arguably the most visible face of Judaism around the world. Reporter Daniel Estrin paid a visit to the movement's Brooklyn headquarters, where adherents are keeping their late spiritual leader's presence alive and where some expect to see him again.
I caught Rabbi Moshe Kotlarsky on one of the few days he's actually back at headquarters. More often than not, he's on a plane, on his way to meet with the emissaries he's dispatched across the globe. There are 4,124 married couples located on every continent, except Antarctica.
Take the Far East, for instance. We're in Thailand, we're in Koh Samui, in Chiang Mai, in Phuket, Pattaya, in Nepal, and Kathmandu, and in Pokhara, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Cameroon, Uganda. There are Jews in places where you wouldn't imagine.
But in many of those places, there's no rabbi or active Jewish community. That's where the Chabad representatives come in.
It is our job to set an example.
Setting an example isn't always easy. Recently, it was tragic. In the 2008 Mumbai terror attack, a Chabad center was targeted and the emissaries lost their lives. In many places, the emissaries are the only recognizably Jewish people around. The man wearing a long beard and black fedora, and his wife covering her hair with a wig for modesty. And they don't always get a warm welcome, either. Some local Jews call them proselytizers. Rabbi Kotlarsky is aware of the sensitivity.
We don't have a right to impose, but we do have a right to set an example.
Chabadniks, as they're known, try to bring Jews into the fold. They're not looking to convert outsiders. On Hanukkah, emissaries light jumbo menorahs at the Champs-Élysées, the Kremlin, and the Great Wall of China. In South America, they host thousands of backpackers for the traditional Passover meal, many of them young Israelis looking for a spiritual fix. But when they're stateside, there's one address in Brooklyn the emissaries always migrate to.
Right there, this building is called 770 Eastern Parkway.
Most call it 770. It's an old Gothic mansion and Chabad world headquarters. Rabbi Simon Jacobson gave me a tour.
So it's on many levels. It's a very profound space. People come here. We'll go inside and I'll show you.
The Rebbe, the movement's last spiritual leader, prayed, lectured, and worked here until his death in 1994. Jacobson used to be one of the Rebbe's scribes. Today, he teaches classes through his Meaningful Life Center. He explains why so many people still flock here so many years after the Rebbe's death.
From a more mystical perspective, you know, when a holy man or a tzaddik, a Rebbe, spends time in a place and he prays there and he cries there and he sees people, you know, we believe that the physical stones and the physical desk and the bookshelves become saturated with the holiness.
As the Rebbe transformed the movement into a global network, this building began to take on a life of its own. Duplicates of 770 started popping up around the globe. In Milan, Melbourne, Sao Paulo, Ukraine, and Israel, you can't miss the brick Gothic replicas. And more duplicates of 770 are in the works. Standing outside 770, Rabbi Joseph Spielman of England says he believes there's a hidden meaning in the address of Chabad headquarters. He explains it with Hebrew numerology, in which letters have numerical value.
Base Mashiach, in other words, in translation, the house of Mashiach, is the numerical value of 770.
You mean that this is the house of the Messiah, Bet Mashiach?
Yeah. Correct, yeah. This is the Rebbe's Mashiach, and this is his home.
When the Rebbe was alive, some of his followers believed him to be the long-awaited Messiah. 17 years after his death, there are still those who fervently believe that, especially those who pray at 770.
What are you guys singing?
What are we singing?
Yeah, what are you singing?
It's in English.
Yeah.
The long live the Rebbe King Mashiach forever and ever.
Leaders of the movement do not support this belief, says Bela Olidort, editor-in-chief of Chabad's official news service. She prefers a different interpretation of 770. It's the numerical equivalent of faratzta, a biblical word meaning to spread out, which is exactly what the Rebbe encouraged, not just to headquarters at 770, but branches of the movement around the world. That was his legacy, says Maya Balakirsky-Katz, author of The Visual Culture of Chabad.
He did not leave his followers with nothing. Instead of him naming an heir, he named a building. You know, everyone's like, well, why didn't he name an heir? Why didn't, you know? He did. 770.
That global network of Chabad centers, Kat says, is helping keep the movement alive without him. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, 770 Eastern Parkway, Crown Heights, in Brooklyn, New York.
Naples through the eyes of a Brooklynite, coming up on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Actor and director John Turturro doesn't trace his roots to Naples. His family came from Sicily, but he's got a passion for Naples, for its brutality and beauty. His latest film takes you on a musical journey to the southern Italian city. It's called Passione, and it's a tribute to the city and the people of Naples. The movie itself is a series of live and recorded performances by some of the best Neapolitan musicians. This is from the soundtrack of Passione.
Più lontano mi stai, più vicino ti senti, chissà chi sto momento, tu che pensi, che fai.
That's the title track from Passione. John Turturro describes Naples as a city painted in sound, and it's not just the music.
The Neapolitan language, which I would consider a language and not a dialect, is a very, very musical language. So everything is kind of sung, whether you're in a restaurant, in conversation, it's all around you. And the people are very expressive and theatrical. They have this kind of ironic, they're emotional, but they're very humorous, fatalistic. At the same time, they're really, you know, generous. There's all this contradiction that you see in it. And, you know, if you are around it and you're working there, it's really striking that there's this authenticity that just comes right out of the ground. One of the singers, who's a fado singer, Mizia, said that the city is like a witch, and it is. It really can permeate your soul when you're there, and it brings you back, you know, backwards and forwards at the same time, because all the problems that have existed in the world have been there, and they also show you like the problems of the future too, because they're a city that has been, you know, oppressed, you know, with natural disasters and man-made conquerors.
John, there are a couple of tracks here from that singer that you just mentioned, Mizia. Which one would you like to hear?
Indifferentemente is a beautiful song.
Let's hear that one.
Let's try that.
Indifferentemente, tanto
to such a castle e te non so più niente e dove sto veleno non aspetta di mano che indifferentemente se tu mi ascire non te riga niente.
What's the image we're seeing in the film as we're hearing music?
She's singing in a courtyard, and she's got a scarf around her, and she looks like a scorned woman. It's a song about lovers, and, you know, and this man has mistreated her, and she says, you know, you do whatever you want to do to me. You just get it over with, you know, poison me, whatever you want to do. It's a beautiful song, actually, and she was really, really, she's a really exceptional performer, and like many other performers in the film, she sings from the ground up.
She sings from the ground up.
It's not a narcissistic expression when you watch a lot of these people sing. They're great storytellers, but there's this need to convey the human experience that the songs are telling about the stories of this place and the people who inhabit it.
I want to talk about track 16. This is Caravan Patrol,
right?
Which you're a part of. Let's hear a bit of this.
Mi scopere con papà, chi sarà salì papà, chi sarà salì papà.
What's the translation?
It's written by Renato Carosone, who was a really brilliant singer-songwriter. And it's all about, you know, this guy, this crazy Neapolitan. He's looking for American petrol. And so he's hunting for oil. Obviously, there was a fuel shortage after the war. And so he buys a camel and a turban. He thinks it's going to help him. And he sets off. He's telling his guys, you know, let's dig, you know, dig, dig, you know, harder, harder. And they're saying, you know, why are you making us do this? So it's a really fun song. And Enzo Avitabile did the arrangement, and Fiorello is the lead singer.
And where are you in that?
I'm in the back. I'm like one of the background dancers and singers with Mexico.
Oh, you're singing it too?
Yeah, in the background. When the chorus joins in.
Caravan Pedro.
I remember Naples as being a place that is so beautiful and so alluring, and you were alluding to this a little bit earlier, but part of the allure is that it's kind of dangerous.
Yes, it is. It really reminded me very much of New York in the 70s, because your senses are on high alert, and maybe, you know, I don't know, when there's poverty, then there's obstacle, and there's crime, and there's, you know, man-made problems combined with natural disasters that could happen to you. Maybe that's the recipe for creativity. I don't know. But certainly when there's obstacles, then there is something to overcome, something to tell, something to try to make sense of your life with. And I think a lot of their music comes from there.
I love this version of O Solo Mio, and I wonder if you have a story you can tell us about it.
That song has been recorded in more languages. It's probably the most popular song in the world, and more times than almost any other song, maybe because of its age. But, you know, we had all different versions and all different languages. But at the end, I thought, you know, if we could find a couple different versions that we could move together, maybe that would be the best version of it. And I'm happy with what we came up with, because we connect the past to the present and hopefully the future.
Oh, sole mie, sam fronte a te, sam fronte a te.
When people see the film, they're really struck by its energy and spontaneity, and the art of improvisation is a real, I always think it's a real Neapolitan art, because it's the art of the poor, you know, people navigating through the challenges of the day. And it really is transporting. And I credit all the wonderful performers in the film for that.
Actor and director John Turturro's newest film is Passione, a musical adventure. Check out clips at theworld.org. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Lisa Mullins. Have a good weekend.
Qui ci sta l'inflazione, la svalutazione, la borsa ce l'ha, chi ce l'ha. Io non tengo con vendica, chi lo stipendi è un ambo, se sogno a papà. Aggiungete mia figlia innocenza, tuo marito non tiene pazienza. Io non chiedo la grazia per me, mi faccio la barba, la satira sì. Voi tenete un cappotto cammello che al massimo processo era la più bella. Un vestito gessato marrone, così c'è sembrata la televisione. Posso in nozza mi prega eccellenza, ma per stanza.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. And by the PRI Program Fund, supporting informed risk-taking in public radio programming. Contributors include Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees.
PRI, Public Radio International.